Blog Talk Radio.
Hi. You know, you hear that laughter in the background? That's the sound of a Democrat laughing hysterically over the news over the past 5 days. That's Congressman Al laughing. He can't make this stuff up. But, you know, we love Al anyway because, you know, we're about civility, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about. In fact, today on Backroom Politics, it's Tuesday, which means that if it's 4 o'clock, as of 4 o'clock, the Republicans have not had a major screw-up today that we can report. Oh, wait, I was wrong. Pressure on Missouri GOP Senate mounts after a disastrous TV appearance. And when in Galilee, do as the GOP does, which, by the way, means skinny dipping in the Holy Land. The Virginia voter ID law is upheld by the Department of Justice. Is this something we should be concerned about? What can we expect from the upcoming conventions? And are they really still relevant? Do the parties matter that much anymore to the voters? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics.
Beautiful day in.
So, missing in action today is Alan Moore, but to my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Well, hi, Justin. Hi, Al. It's a good day to be here.
And missing in action, we've got Alan Moore is out in the wilderness doing his best impression of Grizzly Adams. I believe Ralph is out and about doing Ralph-type stuff, and haven't heard from Carl.
And I don't know what Carl may show up yet.
Carl may show up, or actually, Carl Tubin, I believe that's you on the line.
That's right.
There you are. Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm up here in Amagansett, Long Island, looking out on the ocean.
Oh, I envy you.
Boy, well, fantastic.
I think we ought to mention, even though he's not going to be a guest in the program, but Tip O'Neill's a former speaker, his oldest son.
His oldest son, actually. Actually, we just, as is common here in Shelley's back room, there are some people of note that you want out and about Shelley's back room. Tommy O'Neill is around. So we, that's correct. So anyway, I'm just going to let you have the fire up on this one, Al. So, you're a Democrat.
Yes.
Former member of Congress.
Yes.
How much did you, like, actually have to convulse before the laughing stopped when you saw the news this weekend? For those of you who don't know, our first story is, it's actually a very serious story. It's the story involving a GOP Senate candidate out of Missouri named Tom Aiken. Aiken was being interviewed on a local news show, where the question came up about abortion. And in his discussion about abortion, Aiken made a comment amounting to, in instances of legitimate rape, a woman's body will shut down, not allowing her to get pregnant, so therefore abortion would not be necessary. I've got to tell you, I mean, I'm a Republican, I'm a moderate Republican. I've been very open about the fact that I'm pro-choice, but even as a pro-life, Bob Hines, that has got to be, without a doubt, one of the greatest, I'm going to come out and say it, that's got to be one of the most asinine things to come out of a politician's mouth in a long time.
Well, it's so obviously biologically stupid, aside from anything else. I mean, how can anybody believe that that is a possibility? It's just crazy.
Continental.
In his defense, he's against illegitimate rape.
Wait, I was going to say. But again,
what is legitimate rape?
That's the question everybody's asking.
What is legitimate rape? I have no concept of what it is.
Well, that's what everybody's asking. Now then, you know, the fallout from this has been just absolutely staggering. Paul Ryan has called Aiken to tell him to drop out. The National Republican Senate Committee has said they will put no money towards Aiken. And yet Aiken, as of 2 o'clock this afternoon, said that he is in this for the long haul. He is not dropping out. Bye-bye.
And I believe I'm right on this. If he does not withdraw by 6 o'clock Friday or some, you know, end of the week, the only way to get him off the ballot is to go to court.
It's today. He's got to do it by 5 o'clock today.
Correct.
Oh my God!
Yeah, correct. Which, as of this hour, we have not seen any indication that he is going to pull out. You know, Carl Tooven, when you hear those comments, this has obviously got to be great fodder for the Democratic Party, even at a national level. I mean, we're going to be talking about two major gaffes and possibly a third later on, but how much energy is the Democrats getting off of such an asinine comment like this?
Well, first of all, I'm trying not to smile, number one. And number two, you know, this has opened up a can of worms that they did not want opened. It relates to the fact that Aiken and Mr. Ryan, Congressman Ryan, have worked together on abortion amendments and to end it with the pill, et cetera, the whole thing. And it just opens up. It shows how far to the right, to conservative right, that Ryan is, and exposes that all to the country. Now, you know, we had an incident weeks ago with abortion, and everybody said, oh, it'll blow over. This will die down.
What incident are you talking about?
We have it again.
Carl, which incident are you talking about?
There was an incident weeks ago, I think, about abortion that came up, and everybody said, "Don't worry, this will die down by the election. We don't have anything to worry about." And you know, boom, it's up again. And this thing isn't going to go away. With all that stuff with women's, you know, all the stuff in Virginia that came out and that Governor McDonald wanted to do and the legislature in Virginia wanted to do, and all the hoopla over that, and everybody said, no, this will die down. Don't worry about it. By Election Day, it'll be forgotten. And boom, now we've got this.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we're also looking at, Congressman Al, is, I mean, there are so many things involving the story that are just mind blowing. Number one, the tactical political error of this. You're going in front of a camera, you're going in front of a statewide televised audience. Does your organization not prep you going in saying, hey, if this subject comes up, this is the mantra we're going to put forward?
Well, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. They always should. But one of the things I found in my own career, having said some stupid things myself, not quite that bad, but bordering on it, is that if you really get comfortable with an audience, you say, these are my people, and we agree, you start talking loose. And I remember before a bunch of way-out liberals, I was getting to feel real comfortable. We were agreeing on this and that and the other thing. And finally I said, now mind you, I'm not as liberal, and I named somebody else in the state's delegation who was their hero. And they turned from a gang of my friends into just a gang, and I barely got out of there alive. It was a stupid remark. I think that's what happened to the senator from Mississippi, Trent Lott.
Trent Lott, yes.
When he was talking before a hungry crowd of hungry Republicans, they were hometown crowd. He was praising a senior member of the party.
Right.
And he no doubt made a mistake. He no doubt went over what he should have said, but it wasn't like he was speaking seriously.
Yeah, that was Trent speaking at a birthday celebration party for the senator from South Carolina, Strom Thurmond.
And what he said was red meat for the Republicans.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, you know, but here's the funny thing. Go ahead.
To sum it up, one wonders whether the audience he was talking to on this radio program or the commentator he was talking to hadn't kind of lulled him into a feeling of security when he said it.
Well, you know, it's...
But one more thing.
Go ahead, Bob Hines.
We're not going to be through with him for a while.
Yeah, Al is right that you can get too relaxed. But here's a guy who is a five-term congressman. Now, I don't know if he's had vigorous races recently, but he certainly probably had a couple early on. And you would think that something as outrageous as he said, something in his brain was not functioning at that moment.
Well, you know, the remarkable thing to me in all this is the issue of when he actually comes out and says something as ludicrous as a doctor has told me. Now, look, I know enough medical professionals to come out and say not a single one of them would ever say something as biologically incorrect or as theoretically
asinine. Doctor of anthropology at the local university.
To me, that makes no sense. And you would think that, as you said, a multiple-term member of Congress from even from a conservative state like Missouri would have enough sense to sit down and go, hey, let's just keep it on message. Let's not come off script. He came completely off script.
And it's also true that this was not an issue that is not a currently active issue in the public body.
It wasn't.
No, the point is that the abortion questions are part of the political structure right now in this campaign. You have to think that it's not as though he just suddenly decided to talk about something that nobody else was talking about. This is something that people have been talking about for the last few months.
But, Congressman Al, go ahead.
Well, I think it will fade a bit with the general public, who those people that aren't particularly keyed up by the abortion issue, one way or the other, and they'll laugh about it and kid about it. They'll be, the women who are the huge supporters of pro-choice will have been kind of laying back lately. They've lost a lot of their enthusiasm and what have you. Nothing could have been better timed to gin these people up, and they'll hold that enthusiasm until election day.
Now, just so you know, the ripple effect that is occurring as a result of Aiken's just idiotic remarks, the people who have who were scheduled to go to a fundraiser for Aiken in Missouri, including Senator McConnell, Senator John Cornyn, John Kyle, Senator Roy Blunt, Mike Lee of Utah, all pulling out of a fundraiser. And then, on top of that...
It's going to be a lonely head table.
it's going to be a very... I would venture to say they'll probably cancel that event. Now then, here's the other thing. On top of that, here's a list of the colleagues, according to our friends at Politico, of people who have said, hey, you might want to consider getting out. This list includes... His own delegation partner, Roy Blunt, Senator Kelly Ayotte out of New Hampshire, Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, Texas Senator John Cornyn, Nevada Senator Dean Heller, Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, and obviously Mitch McConnell and Olympia Snow. That is a pretty high-ranking Republican list of people that if I got a phone call from them, I would probably take a look and go, I might want to reconsider this if I want to have any credibility in politics. Bob, that list would get your attention?
Well, not only that, but look at it this way. If most of those senators are very practical people. The race in Missouri is a very close race. The fact of the matter is that the Democratic Senator McCaskill is popular, but not that popular. Missouri is a relatively conservative state. Republicans were looking pretty, maybe doing pretty well there, and suddenly, most of these senators who are asking him to rethink his keeping staying in the race are looking at losing a Republican colleague that they were hoping would be elected in November.
According to a lot of polling data that we've seen coming out of Missouri, quite frankly, comes to now. Aiken was going to take out Claire McCaskill, and it would have been a Republican red Senate state.
Looks like he was going. I remember running a campaign against a friend of mine who was a Republican, supporting a Republican candidate, and these were two opposing each other, and his candidate said something stupid, just as stupid as this. And I remember him sidling up to me, and he says, "Al, you want to write the press release, or shall I?"
But, you know, we look at all this and we take all this in. Now we've talked a little bit about the political and just the jumping off the ship that major Republican senators are doing on the Aiken campaign. Is this going to have an impact, do you think, on fundraising, Bob?
Well, it's certainly...
Not for just him, but for the Republican Party as a whole.
Well, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. For him, I can't imagine anybody putting any money in it unless they're the Koch brothers, maybe. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, the reality is that he has just, he has seriously soiled his campaign. He has no way to go, but the only honorable thing he can do is to announce before the deadline, which I gather is today, at 5:00. Now, if that's the case,
he's got 40 minutes.
We'll monitor the situation. We'll wait for breaking news.
And if he doesn't get out and screws up the whole situation in Missouri for the Republican Senate candidate, whoever it becomes at that point, I mean, he is going to be excoriated by his fellow colleagues.
Carl Tooven, do you think that this is going to, I mean, do you have a feeling in your experience being former chairman of a state party, is this going to affect party fundraising in your opinion?
Well, it'll affect party fundraising, but you know, there are a lot of groups out in Missouri, and there's that, I think it's the Family Council whose head came out in supporting of the congressman. And there are a lot of very conservative groups in Missouri that will still back him. So he'll have money, not the money that he was expecting. I mean, he's lost the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. He's lost Karl Rove, and that's a big chunk of money. And he was anticipating that to help him beat Senator McCaskill. And it's a disaster, real disaster.
Well, it's a disaster if you're a Republican hoping for another Republican senator, but I would venture to say, Congressman Al is a Democrat, having Claire McCaskill staying in the Senate is kind of a warm possibility for you.
Well, this is the kind of thing that happens in campaigns that makes you believe in God again.
This coming from my atheist friend from Washington State.
Right.
I rather thought it was Satan activating himself again.
It all depends on which side of that hole you're on.
Right.
You just can't hope for things like that. Now, the reason that I, as a Democrat, don't want to hoot and holler and do too much on this is that Democrats have been known to stick their foot in their mouth all the way up to
their hip,
too.
Absolutely.
And they have 3 months yet in which to do it.
And I venture to say there's probably a congressman that we could probably find with a whole stack of money in a freezer somewhere.
Well, they'll be...
Allegedly.
There certainly will be some small ones. Yeah. I mean, that's...
Well, I would be amazed if in the next 60 to 90 days... there are not further slips of the tongue, and either bigger slips than that, among candidates of both parties.
But I want to talk about this in a more general term later on. But just to touch on it real quick, are the slip ups because we're getting more verbose? We're trying to get that 30-second soundbite, or Is it because that the 30-second soundbite there, they're monitoring everything?
In
Congressman
this,
Al?
In this particular case, I think it is because that issue, the issue of abortion, has people from one side to the other in varying degrees. I had people who were staunch anti-abortion people who were willing to support me.
Right.
They believed against abortion, but it wasn't that kind of doomsday thing for them, as it obviously is for Congressman Aiken. And I think the more you fervent you become, and the more enthusiastic you become, and the more you just believe down in your gut that this is absolutely the truth, the more likely you are to make a stupid remark like that.
And I would suggest to you that, as we all know, the Congress, and I guess particularly the House, has become more and more ideologically divided than it has ever been, at least in my lifetime, which is all too many years. But you know, and I think that you have more and more people who, on abortion issues and other issues, are diametrically opposed to the death on these
but
things.
But what Congressman Aiken said was, I mean, it leaves all demagoguery behind and just goes into the ludicrous and stupid. But it seems like there's a fine line. I mean, to the point where there are people actually backing what Aiken said. One of them is notorious religious right-wing nut Kirk Cameron, who defends what Todd Aiken said. He represents a part of the right that will probably say, you know what, we'll still back you. We want that kind of voice in Congress.
There is something else going on in the religious right that we should keep in mind, in which this might even help hurry it along. Some of the younger, ultra-conservative religious people have turned to social issues as we normally think of, helping the poor, helping children, education, those kinds of things. They've been turning away from gay marriage and abortion and all those kinds of issues. And if anything, and they're going to come out of this unscathed. People aren't against religion, and they're not against conservative religion. So they may end up, sitting in the catbird seat with that part of the Republican Party that is very religious.
Bob, you agree with that? You think that this is actually almost a launching point for the right-wing, religious right, moral majority types?
I don't. No,
I didn't say the moral majority.
No, and I don't think Al thinks it's a launching pad, but I think he is correct that some of the more conservative and younger people are looking at other kinds of issues rather than these interpersonal relationships. Let's call it. I mean, the reality is that they've come to a conclusion that there are more important things than fussing about this, and some of the social projects that they can help on and do some good with are where they want to be rather than fighting over abortion or gay rights.
Well, and they even argue that's where Christ would be.
And who's to say?
Yeah, well,
we weren't there when he was.
No. I am not allowing this conversation to go any further. We're going to stop that right now. In fact, wow, look at that. We're up against the break. My God. I do want to make this one point. I know several people who I'm close to. I know a couple who have been involved in sexual assault and rapes. And I will tell you that I very rarely get personal or get on a soapbox of this personal nature on the show, but I'm going to do this right now. I find Congressman Aiken's comments to be not only idiotic, asinine, and inaccurate, but it just digs at the moral sensibility of everything that I think that our party, as the Republican Party, has stood for. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say, I personally want to see him stand down. I think it's a travesty if he goes forward. That's just my take.
I would just say that you could speak for both parties in that regard. The Democrats were there a long time
ago. This is such a stupid thing. There are so many serious, important issues to be discussed that need to be discussed, and this is one of the most stupid things I have ever heard anybody say. I cannot imagine any medical person in the country, in the universe, to say that what he said makes any sense biologically.
But the lifetime of trauma that a woman has to go through after experiencing something of that violent of a nature is something that you just don't shake. And for him to call it out and say, well, biologically the body just shuts it down, and oh, you know what, pregnancy after rape, that's such a minor point.
Absolutely insulting
to the American electorate. Al, you were going to say something.
Well, I just had one more thought, and this is something Bob has said for years, and Bob and I don't totally agree on abortion. He's against abortion, I'm for it. But he believes that it's the kind of issue that really should be settled at the local level or the state level. I happen to think that it's an issue that should be settled in the society, through the churches, and through the other organizations. The government has, frankly, more important things to do than wring their hands over what are essentially religious and moral issues. Gay marriage, you know, the whole slave ethic. We've got foreign policy to deal with, an economy to deal with, all kinds of issues that the government officials should be paying attention to, not sitting around making stupid statements about abortion.
Absolutely agree. We're right here. When we come back, we're going to talk about something of a little lighter note. Another GOP screw-up over the past 72 hours that broke over the weekend. You can stop laughing now, Al. It's just... Although...
I don't even know what it is.
You're still smiling. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 4 minutes.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
one more once.
Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue on because apparently today's theme of the show is how could the GOP flub up this time? Well, just when you thought it couldn't get any weirder, skinny dipping congressional members in the Sea of Galilee in the Holy Land. So, according to a story that was broken that broke over the weekend by our friends at Politico, there were several Republican members. There were several Republican congressional members that went over to Israel around a trip that was brought together by a suborganization of AIPAC. And for those of you who do not remember, when we talk about AIPAC, AIPAC is the American Israeli Political Action Committee. It is a pro-Israeli, pro-U.S.-Israeli relations organization. They have an education foundation, which apparently brought these members over. Including, or during this CODEL, or this trip, the FBI investigated reports that Congressman Kevin Yoder of Kansas went skinny dipping in the Sea of Galilee in front of allegedly several members of Congress and their families. Let's just start off.
He was just trying to see if he could walk on water.
Okay. So what he is referring to is saying that he and other congressmen wanted to be where Jesus walked on water, and there was no inappropriate or unusual behavior that I saw. That's a quote from Representative Ben Quayle, who was part of this delegation.
Somebody actually said that?
Actually said that they wanted to be where Jesus walked on water.
I thought it was a funny joke.
No. This is why you're laughing. So you just saw it couldn't get weird. So we've talked about this. First of all, let's just go to the obvious. One, is it inappropriate for, I mean, they're not there on a quote-unquote official capacity per se. They're on their off time. You know, they happen to be in an area where they want to go swimming. Is that unusual, Bob? I mean, is this really?
I certainly hope so.
but
no, look.
But Robert,
hey,
I mean,
no, wait a minute. Look, these are, whether it is an official visit or not, these are members of the United States House of Representatives, our
They're
government.
There because
they are there because of that. They are there dealing with Israeli officials, discussing matters of interest to both parties, and doing something like this is just too much. I mean, I don't care whether it's an official government meeting or not. The fact is, officials of both governments are sitting down and discussing matters of mutual interest. That it makes it an important, if not an official, meeting. And to have, even if it isn't an official meeting, you don't go skinny dipping.
I would expect that answer from a conservative person like Bob. Al, I know that you, as a former member of Congress, and a liberal Democrat at that, would have no problem skinny dipping in the Sea of Galilee on a CODEL. Is this something you've done in the past?
may I say one thing?
Mm-hmm.
I hope Al has never done it, and if he has, I would advise him not to say so publicly now.
You know, no, the only thing that I have ever personally had that even came close to this was one member. He happened to be a Republican. His name shall remain Anonymous, who rented a boat and some binoculars and drove as closely along a nude bathing beach that as he could get and watched as carefully as he could.
Oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, and
his trunks were on.
His trunk. Well, thank God, because I mean, Carl Tubin, when we look at this story, and you being a longtime Washington insider, is this really a news story? Is this something that the general public needs to know? Is this something really that the FBI needs to investigate?
Well, first of all, the FBI yesterday said that they weren't called in to investigate. That.
Carl?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
You got to remember, these people, they were there with Eric Cantor. Eric Cantor went off someplace that evening, and they all had dinner. They were they had evidently plenty of drinks, and then they went out, and, you know, one jumped in and the rest followed. But this is something that, you know, I think all these people are embarrassed. They probably thought, geez, the year's gone by. This was August 11th of 2011. The year's gone by. Maybe we won't get found out. And evidently the people from Politico doing their work found out somehow, some way. I don't know how they're going to go back to their constituents and say, I jumped in the Sea of Galilee. It's a tough one.
Bob, is this something that is going to cause maybe an ethics committee investigation? Do you think that the Hill is looking at this?
I don't think that there were any of the rules of the House broken, which is the only thing the ethics committee can really look at. It's just stupid behavior.
Congressman Al?
It's not a crime to be an idiot. You know. Even when in poor taste. Now, do we also know whether he was the only one that did it, or were
he is the only one allegedly? Now, let's be clear. This is coming off of reports that we're getting our information from our friends at Politico and other news sources now that have since gone after this since it broke over the weekend. But according to multiple news sources, there were several members. That were there, including Congressman Quayle out of Arizona. Kevin Yoder is the only one who swam nude in the Sea of Galilee during this incident. According to Congressman Quayle, I was not around when Congressman Yoder entered the water. I was not in the water or near any of that, but was able to go in properly attired. I have to say that, and swim very briefly in the Sea of Galilee. So, again, there's only one person who went in skinny dipping, apparently.
Has anybody used the "I was being baptized" argument yet?
Wow. No, Al, I don't believe they have.
Well, they can have that for free.
Wow. Every once in a while we get one of those shows where it's just kind of, you know, the three, the four of us, and we can kind of just go off on a tangent. That's fine. We can have those shows when they all can be over.
More seriously, what I think is that this will be a big laugh for most people for half a week. Those that were involved, particularly the new man, he's going to have problems back in his district. The rest will probably have a problem more with the fact that they took a congressional trip, which are never popular, and did something a little questionable, but they all have their clothes on. And is it somehow immoral to dip your toe in the Sea of Galilee? I don't think so. So I think that this is not going to be a big thing, except for the nude guy.
which by nude guy, you mean the congressman from Kansas.
Yeah, let's hope he's got a big face so that he won't be embarrassed further.
But in all seriousness, I mean, there were other people there. Wow. Really, Al? That just hit me. Did you really just say that out loud? We're on the air.
No.
The hot mic.
No, I didn't
Yeah, poor Stein. Other freshman lawmakers that also went swimming that night, according to several sources in the GOP, according to our friends at Politico, include Congressman Steve Sutherland out of Florida, and his daughter, who is with them while this is going on, Congressman Tom Reed out of New York and his wife, Congressman Quayle, Jeff Denham out of California, Michael Grimm out of New York. They say they went into the water because, not because they were baptized, but according to several GOP sources, they're saying they went in for quote-unquote religious significance.
You know, the only people who are going to have any trouble are the ones who did it. I mean, they're back home. They'll probably have to have an answer for why they did it, and et cetera, in the race that they're all running for re-election. And Mr. Yoder may have more, will certainly have more trouble than anyone else. But this is one of those stupid things that sometimes smart people do when they're away and feeling loose and free and
drunk.
Drunk.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's it. That's
and,
all.
And again, letting me be clear. You know, allegedly they did admit that they have drinks. Now their sobriety, we're not going to question that. That's not in question.
We don't need to. It's pretty obvious.
We're the last people in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you know, in the next 15 minutes, we're going to be ordering our drinks and cutting our cigars open.
But we have our clothes on.
We do have our clothes on. But here's the thing. Here's
well, that can be fixed.
No, Al. Again, Al.
Okay, Al.
But here's the thing. Is,
did you ever notice how Democrats say these wild things from time to time?
Yes, and it's the picture of Al nude swimming. Yeah. I don't need in my head. Thanks. We're driving people out of Shelley's. My God.
Nobody needs that picture in
exactly. The reason why I wanted to bring this up today, though, in all honesty, is I wanted to bring it up because of the fact that we've talked about these types of trips, these CODELs, if you will. And this was not obviously an official CODEL,
no.
Per se. This is something that several freshman members, along with, by the way, Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Minority Whip Kevin McCarthy, were also on the trip, but not part of the swimming group.
Yeah.
The CODELs we've talked about, saying this is a good way for congressmen to get to know each other, get to work together.
Yeah, but we didn't mean it that way.
But Congressman Al, you have been a huge fan of CODELs.
Yes.
Especially when members of both parties are involved.
Yes.
Is it silly stuff like this that gets the American electorate a little bit angry and think these are just boondoggles where people can go skinny dipping in the Sea of Galilee?
It's silly stuff like that. It is also sometimes just mindless, thoughtless things that they shouldn't be doing, because it makes the whole trip look like it's essentially a vacation rather than a congressional delegation that's looking into things. I only took one CODEL every term, so I had eight. Or did I take the ninth one? I'm not sure. And all but one of those was orchestrated by John Dingell. We've talked about him a lot on the...
Well, he's a good friend of yours, obviously, from the House.
He's the most senior member of the House, and they've been around forever. He organized those CODELs so that you spent the vast majority of your time, in fact, every day but weekends, you spent working. You were in working meetings, sometimes you were so tuckered out at the end of the day that you had no question you were working. But you could come home and do what I did, and a report on that CODEL was my service club speech for 3 months.
Right.
Because I'd learned so much. I was so impressed with what I had learned. Now, that kind of CODEL is justifiable. The media should make very careful when they criticize CODELs that they've got the right one, and so forth and so on. This, of course, makes a CODEL, tarnishes the image of any CODEL, and it's unfortunate.
Bob Hines.
Let's remind ourselves of something. People come up to Congress. Most, for the most part, they have not been exposed to a great deal of international or national issues or matters of concern that they're going to have to be dealing with in their responsibilities on the committees. It isn't just a foreign affairs committee that deals with international issues. I mean, environmental issues, agricultural issues,
transportation issues.
There's all kinds of things that you need to know about, and they go beyond what you can learn sitting in Washington. And, you know,
what you learn is that those two oceans really isolate us mentally.
Right.
And you get over to Europe, for example, and see how they look at developing countries, which they call the South, underdeveloped countries of the South and the developed ones of the North. They use those terms. But they have concerns about those. They approach them slightly differently than we do. It's something that we should know when we're looking at foreign aid and that kind of stuff. And that there's no way of learning it in a book.
No. What? Consider this one thing. Patents, intellectual property rights. This is one of the largest issues in any government's, any major government in the world today.
Right.
We spent a lot of that time on that in Brazil, which is one of the major malefactors.
Yes.
When
yeah.
we took a Codel
sure.
there.
Right.
And there, it is impossible for Americans to sit here, the FCC people, the Federal Communications Commission. How can they know what's going on around the world unless they and their staffs do some traveling? How can the federal government's congressional delegation from the Commerce Committee, the committee that deals with communications rights, patent rights, you've got to go and talk to your fellow colleagues in other countries who have the same problems that you do with it, and how are we going to organize an internationally fair system?
Congressman Al.
It's one thing to read that Brazil does these things and has no intention of stopping. It's another to sit down with essentially their Secretary of Commerce, who tells you to your face, we're doing it and we're not going to stop it. And then you begin to understand, you know, the difficulty of the problem we're dealing with.
Well, but let's take this trip, for example. I mean, you know, obviously bringing freshman Republicans over to Israel makes sense. Israel is going to be a key part of what's going on in our foreign affairs policy, particularly with the tension that we have with Iran. So this does make sense, but you can't expect them 24 hours a day to be nose to the grindstone. There's got to be some time for them to have some personal time, either with their families who may come on these trips, or, you know, with other members, getting to know them, having dinner. Nothing says they can't have a few drinks during dinner. All of these issues come up. This makes sense. But when stories like this come out about the after-hour stuff, is, I think, what gets the American electorate angry, saying, how do we trust these guys when they're off blowing American tax dollars on these boondoggles so they can go swimming? Is that an accurate portrayal, Bob?
Well, that isn't because the Jewish organization is paying for it in this instance. But with so many legitimate codels being paid for by the government, you're right.
You know what's interesting here? Al said that when he took a codel, when he went home for the next few months, he talked about what he had done and learned on that business trip, that codel. Now, it strikes me that if other members of Congress were as diligent as that, is in effect to use that as a foundation for remarks and speeches he gives back home to a variety of different groups, so that they would then begin, folks back home all over the country would begin to understand there are values to my congressman going around the world on this particular issue. It's worthwhile to be doing, and he learned something that is important for our government to know so they can work accordingly with the international work problems they've got to deal with.
And what Dingell did that was so brilliant is he would send out to every person that was going an agenda of what it was they were going, and a suggested press release to tell your people you were going and why you were going. Then you went, you did what he said you were going to do, and then you came home and you issued findings, which you could then talk about. I mean, that's the way to do it right.
It's a little work, but it would be an awful big help for the general public to begin to understand that it is important that American public officials who may never have left their hometown or their state, you know, in international travel, but these problems, there are so many problems that are international, and they require our government individuals to talk to the other governments, and not just at the Secretary of Transportation or Ag level, but at a level that is broader than that. When you come home having learned some things, it can affect how you decide what the agriculture policy is going to be.
I mean, looking back, and I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Sure.
We're talking about a trip that happened over a year ago. And Congressman Al, you've been on several trips, both CODELs and, you know, organizational sponsored travel.
One.
Where you got back and you had to file the appropriate ethics paperwork. This happened a year ago. Why would this news break now? If, you know, this is obviously something that the ethics committee signed off on. They approved the paperwork on and the finance of it.
Well, we get back to our friends in the media. I think the media either will cover these if they think there's something juicy and inflammatory and negative, or they won't carry them at all. And this one, they apparently just slipped their mind.
Somebody talked.
Well, first of all, the Jewish organization runs these all the time. These are one of many, many, many.
Yeah. And to be clear, the organization we are talking about is associated with AIPAC. It is the American Israeli Educational Foundation, which does this every year with freshman lawmakers.
And there probably are not a lot of skinny dipping going on at those things. So the media looks at this as another yawn AIPAC trip. With freshman congressman and flips to the next page.
Is this something really that's going to affect GOP members more individually, or is it something that the GOP is going to have to put out, Bob?
Well, it'll obviously affect Republicans a little more clearly than it will Democrats, but it's going to redound to the Congress as a whole or the House as a whole, because, you know, what are they doing over there, and isn't this stupid, and it's wasting our money, and, you know, blah, 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 the usual complaints. It's unfortunate that it happens, and Lord knows it, you know, people do stupid things, and it's clear to me that it will never stop happening. You hope it'll be a while before anybody else does anything as foolish as this.
Well, it also would suggest that these should be bipartisan. If this had been bipartisan, it would have been Democrats and Republicans that were caught up in it. Or what is even more likely, had there been Democrats around, there'd have been no skinny dipping, because they'd be keeping an eye on each other.
Or jointly.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, Al's right. Al's right. If every trip was a bipartisan trip, if every trip was a bipartisan trip, you wouldn't have any possibility of leaks from the group.
Wow.
They'd try to make sure that they didn't get themselves in a box.
Al?
Well, I remember one guy went on one trip. He was a very, very religious man, Mormon, I believe, and he was kind of torn as to whether he should report that we drank. somebody spilled some brandy on him as they were leaving a party, and the next day he had to wear the same pants. When they got back to the hotel, he was worried that somebody from Salt Lake City might smell him as he went through the lobby, and that word would get back that he'd been drinking. The next morning, he was on the bus, and Ed Madigan, wonderful, wonderful Republican from Illinois, got on and wandered down the aisle very nonchalantly. Just as he went by, he says, "Oh, good morning, old Brandy Pants." And embarrassed the poor man all over again.
Do you think this event is just a minor blip on arguably an up and coming freshman in Kevin Yoder, or is this something he needs to be concerned about in another year and a half?
Well, it's unfortunate that this comes out just before, you know, when it's election fodder.
Right.
But I don't think anybody can think this is some horrendous bad habit or some embarrassment to the United States or anything like that.
I think if any member is hurt by this, it will be Yoder.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody else will be who was on the trip and did not go skinny dipping is going to happen.
Right. Well, we'll obviously keep an eye on that. It is now 3 minutes to five, at which time it's 4 o'clock Central Time. By hopefully the close, we'll find out about Congressman Aiken and his run for the Senate 1 hour before he can pull out. When we come back, I do want to talk about the upcoming conventions. A lot of talk around the conventions, a lot of platform talk, you know, a lot of excitement. My question is, are they still relevant? We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Back Room has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings. Famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich. The sandwich named after me. Breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio, as we are every Tuesday from 4 to 6. I want to talk a little bit now about the upcoming conventions for both parties. Next week, the Republicans will convene in the great city of Tampa, in the great state of Florida, my former state of residence. And week after that, the Democrats will gather in Charlotte, North Carolina. Al, I want to go to you first because there's been a lot of controversy about the Democrats picking Charlotte, North Carolina. One, it's a right-to-work state, which has gotten a lot of the labor unions a little bit upset. There's a lot of questions. Can Charlotte handle? Do they have enough hotel rooms to handle an influx of travelers like for the Democratic convention? Are those found solid arguments about going to Charlotte? Was Charlotte the right choice?
Well, they sound to me like they're legitimate questions to ask and pose some problems that have to be resolved. Now, I'm assuming they'll do that. I remember Atlanta. There was a big controversy over whether it could handle it. And everybody for a long time thought, you know, Chicago, New York, both of which are too expensive because of labor unions, Los Angeles, you know, and they're needing to find, for expense reasons, smaller and smaller cities. So I don't care. It's either going to work or it's not going to work, and it's not my job. So.
Carl Toobin, you've also heard the controversy around the Democrats going to Charlotte. Do you agree with that as a former state party chairman?
Well, you know, at the time when they agreed to go to Charlotte, they thought that there was a possibility of carrying North Carolina. So, therefore, they wanted to go to Charlotte to kind of nail it down. Things have changed since then, and it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get to have North Carolina in the Democratic column. So the reasoning was possibly good at the beginning, but, you know, now it's no use discussing it because we're going to Charlotte. The big question is, and can Charlotte handle this group? For example, in 1960, when the convention went to California, I had half of my Marylanders in the headquarters hotel and half of them in Santa Barbara. And they had to be bused in from Santa Barbara every day. And they were not happy with that situation. I'm taking a group from Vietnam Veterans of America. We were in Lake Norman, which is 25 miles from downtown Charlotte. I'm very lucky. I just got my rooms changed to the airport, the Sheraton at the airport, which is 7 miles from downtown Charlotte. So that's the kind of thing that people are going to be faced with when they get to Charlotte, and they've got a bus transportation group working. Hopefully that'll work well, but you know, it's almost like the California situation all over again. But the other thing is that there are a lot of people who are not going to go to the convention this year. A lot of lobbyists aren't coming. They're not going to do a lot of events because of the lobbying laws. So that will cut down on people, but we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, it definitely brings up a good point, Congressman Al, when we talk about the Democratic Convention. I mean, there's still going to be some very big headlining events. The rapper Jay-Z, he does rap music, in case you don't know that, Al. It's a little bit after your time.
Yeah, this has to do with swaddling himself in...
No, Al. He's a very successful musician and businessman. But Jay-Z will be performing. The B-52s, another popular group, will be performing. There's going to be a lot of performances, obviously. But I guess the key thing that we're looking for, though, is it's going to be harder to get the platform... Is it going to be harder for them to get the platform and get it, everybody's arms wrapped around it when everybody's thinking we're in a state that we can't possibly win? Or is it just, hey, this is the Democratic Convention. This is the card we've been dealt. We just have to play it.
Well, it seems to me that in recent years, in fact, actually the last 30 years or so, that the big fights on the platform are gone. I used to sit by the radio and listen to the Democrats and the Republicans fight over the the various ballot issues that have votes on it and have fiery speeches. And that's all been worked out behind so it's smooth and makes the convention, frankly, pretty boring.
Well, that actually brings up a good point. You know, when we look at Bob, you've been involved in numerous conventions. I think, was it three as parliamentarian?
Well, for three of the three conventions, I was the assistant parliamentarian. As a congressman, was always the parliamentarian, but I was the assistant.
Who has no idea what he's doing there. So
well, that's why they have Bob there.
And I was there for several conventions for NBC. Representing NBC and, you know, having some social whatnot. And, conventions have become much more structured, much more time-sensitive for a very simple reason in my book, and that is the media no longer covers conventions the way they used to.
Yeah.
For the reasons I just suggested. Yeah,
right.
Nothing's going on.
Carl Tobin, have the conventions lost their allure as the rallying point for the parties, particularly, in your case, the Democrats?
I don't think they've lost the allure of the rallying point. It is a big rallying point. I mean, you're going to have former President Clinton talk on Tuesday night. You're going to have Vice President Biden talk on Wednesday night, and then you're going to have the major speech by the president on Thursday night, and this speech will resonate throughout the country and hopefully rally the troops, not only the troops in Charlotte, but also the troops, the base of the party, and other people in the independents throughout the country. So I don't think it's a lost cause. And, you know, as we all know, they've cut the conventions down. It used to be 4 days, and now it's only three. And at some point, it might only be two. So, I mean, it gets smaller and smaller as we go forward.
But Bob, because they're getting smaller and smaller, but because of the fact that we don't have the coverage we used to, I mean, much like Al around the radio, I remember growing up and watching John Chancellor for, you know, upwards of 4 hours a night.
Yeah.
Covering every speech, every platform debate. It was, you know, interviews on the floor. You know, we remember David Brinkley
on
the floor.
Well, the afternoon sessions were covered.
Right. And it was an all-day, much like the Olympics were covered.
Well, you had events such as John Chancellor, the security people didn't want him on the floor, and they picked him up and carried him out. And John Chancellor, bless his heart, you could see him on the screen with his microphone. He was being carried up on their shoulders. He was absolutely black.
And he said, "This is John Chancellor somewhere in custody."
but you know, we grew up, a lot of us grew up and remember the days where, you know, if you were a Republican, you were glued to the TV set for hours.
Yep.
Now, because of the fact that the networks aren't covering it as extensive as they are. Is that mainly because we now have a 24-hour news cycle that we're always barraged with constant political facts that we've lost interest in the parties? Congressman Al, you're waving your hand. What's your take?
Well, I think that contributes to it, but the fact is the conventions no longer do anything.
What do you mean they don't do anything?
Well, they highlight certain speeches. That's important. That's the rallying part of the whole thing. But they don't really do the platform there.
No.
And they don't really have the number of state roll calls that they used to.
The last time that I can remember a fight on the platform at a Republican convention was...
84.
No. It was 76.
Really?
Yeah. Because... That was the time that Reagan was trying to wrest the nomination from Ford, which he failed to do by a very close vote. But the fact that he was using a foreign policy platform issue to try to engender the number of votes he could win, and that was a brawl. on the floor on the platform. So last time I can remember a platform actually being struggled over and actually being roll call votes on it that were really confrontational, very close.
But it does beg the question, though. I mean, because theoretically we should have arguments on several platform agendas. You know, if you look at, you know, some of the big five. Some of the big five issues that we're going to look at as GOP in Tampa, you look at gay marriage, for example. Obviously, there's going to be some divisiveness in that. It's going to be your Northeast moderate Republicans, your Northwest moderate Republicans versus your Christian right.
There aren't very many moderate Republicans in the Northeast anymore. That's a reality.
Really?
I mean, how many senators and congresspeople do we have from the Northeast?
Other than Scott Brown, Olympia Soh, Susan Collins.
That's right.
Peter King, arguably, is fairly moderate.
Well, okay.
You
got four.
You've got people.
And you want to know?
You've got people. I mean, Chris Christie would arguably be considered.
I would not consider
somewhat moderate.
Yeah. Well, the point is. We're reaching. 25 years ago, Saltonstall. There were more Republican senators in the Senate from the Northeast than there were Democrats.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
The world has changed.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at, though, is, you know, when you look at the issue, you know, the big issues that will probably come up on the platform: gay marriage, abortion, national security, perhaps.
Most of those decisions are going to be made within the platform, and there will be very little dispute on the floor. Mark my words.
States' rights, a very divisive issue within the GOP.
1948 was the last time that was.
But when you look at the party itself, and you look at some of the divisiveness in the parties, in the Republican Party, you have the Tea Party, which will argue against the mainstream party. On the left, you have the Occupy people arguing with some of the more mainstream Democrats. Are we in a situation? You know what? I just violated my own rule. I didn't turn off my ringer. When we look at the divisiveness with the party itself, are the parties becoming irrelevant? Are we losing interest in the parties, Bob?
No, they're not irrelevant. They never will be irrelevant as long as we have the system we have today. How they do their business is changing because people are watching.
Congressman Al.
This is what seems so obvious to me. The conventions today are totally different animals than the conventions used to be.
Yep.
Their purpose is different. They are used for different reasons. They are structured differently. They just aren't the old free-for-alls that we used to enjoy so much listening to on the radio when I was a boy. So let's face it, that's it. We're just not going to have those. That means that the networks responded by saying, well, if what we're going to have is a bunch of speeches by minor, relatively speaking, minor officials all day long, we might as well show the soap operas. And some of that Scotchman came in to hear.
Again, violating my own thing of turning the damn ringer off. Carl Tubin, go ahead.
Some of this is going to be carried on by C-SPAN, which most likely will have gavel-to-gavel coverage. The only people that lose out are the Senate candidates, some of whom will want to get some national exposure, and some House candidates that might want to get some national exposure. But let me go back to the platform, and I want to ask Justin and Bob this question. With all the hoopla over the, you know, abortion and all the things that have come out in the last few days with the Ryan Amendment, et cetera, will the Republicans be able to put in the same plank as they have in the last two conventions with regard to abortion, or will there be discussion about that, because as one commentator said on MSNBC today, is that Plank evidently is out of step with Romney Ryan thinking, whatever that means.
If you're asking me that question, I can give you my opinion. I would venture to call out that, particularly with Aiken's comments of the past 24, 48 hours, I think that that's now going to be a third rail that they're going to take back a little bit. I don't think it'll get necessarily the discussion time on the floor that we would normally see if it was just about the topic of pro-life, pro-choice. What I will say, though, is it is not in step with what the Romney, and again, this is just my opinion, with Romney and Ryan, only because of the fact that I think it's a secondary issue that obviously everybody's worried about the economy, they're worried about jobs, they're worried about national security with what's going on in Iran, in Syria, in the Middle East. I think you're going to see more of a focus on that. And I think that the bigger topic in this, in my opinion, when it comes to taxes, the budget, you're going to see a large, or you should be able to see a larger discussion on states' rights, especially when you bring up something like Obamacare. States' rights is going to be an issue, and I think it's going to have a good part of the discussion that happens on the floor. I just don't see abortion being a big plank owner in this convention. Bob, what do you think?
I agree with you. I think that they're not going to want to have at the Republican convention a fight over abortion. They're not going to want to have that problem. It makes no sense. And they're going to do everything they can to keep it quiet, and they will work out a way to do so. If they don't work out a way to do so, it'll just show you how totally hopeless the whole situation is. They have to do it.
Yeah.
It makes no sense to have a debate over that stuff.
I agree, but I do want to go back to the idea about the influence of the party. I mean, what we have now is we have a situation where we have the Tea Party on the right, the Occupy on the left. We've seen it in multiple primaries, including one that I was very close to, where the Tea Party and the Occupy, the fringe left, fringe right, are just running amok and driving a lot of this. Do we have weaker parties now than we did, let's say, 20 years ago?
No, we have less dominating control.
Al?
That's what we have.
Al?
That's right. No, you have to go 40 years back where you might be able to say that there was a great difference. But... But no, I don't think so.
Carl, I want to go to you on this, because being a former state chairman, do you feel that the parties are stronger or weaker now than they were, let's say, again, 20 years ago?
I think they're still pretty strong. I think that, we're going to see a big ground game. A lot of that is from the state party networks and the presidential campaigns, but I think that parties are still very, very strong.
Well, I just
Congressman Al.
George McGovern is a very nice man, but sometimes he has some screwy ideas, and he was put in charge of reforming the way in which conventions are held at the local level all the way up. And in the process, the idea was to include more people. What he did was he excluded more Democrats, as in the Democrats that do all the work year-round and so forth and so on. And it's people who come up with an issue for that election, and they are able to muscle their way in at the precinct. Take over county conventions, then the party has a heck of a time in trying to keep that from turning into an insane asylum at the state convention. And it's usually at the state convention that they manage to tamp all this down so that they...
Not the state convention I was at about a few months ago. I can say that right now.
Well, I didn't say that it was calm. I said that's where they tamp it down. There was a result. There was a conclusion to that convention, was there not? And that will go on to the national convention, keeping the national convention calmer. You're not likely to see something like the
Democrats.
We
won't see Chicago.
You won't see Chicago. Now, you could see Chicago again sometime down the future if a big issue like that, like the war was at that time, and there was no way to contain it. But the Democrats, and I don't think the Republicans, have an issue of that size and controversy that they're going to have to tamp down, shut up, shove off, you know.
Bob Hines.
You ask if, you know, if they're going to be the two parties, how are they doing? Look.
And we have a two-party system.
This year, there was an independent effort with some money behind it called America Elects.
Correct.
Which was trying to be a third person, a third party, not just on a... on a Donald Trump or a
Michael Bloomberg.
Not just something silly, but serious. And they couldn't make it happen. They couldn't even get to first base. And the reason they couldn't get to first base is because the two-party system in this part, and we are fortunate in this state. I would suggest to you that if you look at Europe, where you have three and four and five parties, all of whom have strong support, and they have these coalition governments that have a very difficult time doing much of anything.
And you said in this state, and you meant in this country.
In this country,
yeah, in this
you're
country,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I would agree with that.
And the fact that we have a two-party system, and which means that you need to have relatively broad parties. Now, I think our parties are narrowing right now. The Democrats are becoming more liberal, the Republicans are becoming more conservative, and I think that's a problem. I think it's a big problem. But the fundamental reality is that we're always, I think, in my lifetime, going to have just two parties because there is just no way for a third party, even if it's financed well, to in effect, break the stranglehold of the fact that the two parties that exist are the only ones that can really function.
Well, I believe that, and I've said this in several speeches that I give on political topics. And I always ask the question. I'm always asked the question, particularly from college students. You know, are we going to see a third or a fourth party in our political landscape, particularly at the federal level? And I give the same answer. Our Congress, in particular, our system of politics, in particular, cannot handle a coalition government. A coalition government does not make sense in our body of Congress. Try if you think there's a logjam now. Picture a president trying to deal or put together a coalition government where there's going to be feuding on all sides. In a parliamentary system, that may work. In our democracy, in our republic system, it does not, and I agree with you. But when I say, are the parties getting weaker? I remember the days, and you guys remember the days, when you had strong party chairs. I think the last one we saw in the GOP was Haley Barbour. We see somewhat of a strong one right now, the Democrats, with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Very vocal. She's very aggressive.
She's vocal and aggressive. That doesn't mean she's effective.
Arguably, I would say that. But you know, when we look at the party chairs, instead of the parties becoming weaker, are we seeing weaker party chairs who are then, that trickles down to where we see a lot less control over who may run, who doesn't run, the platform, etc.
Yes.
Congressman Allen?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
You see that?
The change that has taken place has weakened the control of what they used to call the party bosses. And if you go way back into Bob's and my extreme youth, you had people who, in fact, met in smoke-filled rooms, made decisions, brought them out, and that was it. Now they're made very, I don't know that they're made better, but they're made very differently.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It And you used to have people who were highly regarded, and you don't have those. They were clearly, when they spoke, minions and state leaders, and it's all around the country, understood that the leader was talking. I'm thinking about somebody like a Ray Bliss, from Ohio, who was probably, he was Ohio, and when he was the chairman of Ohio, the Republican Party in that state ran like a clock. And then he took over the national after the disaster with Nixon, and he ran a very good ship for about 6 years, 6 or 8 years.
Well, in New York, you had Carmen DeSapio, and there was a lot of question about whether there was corruption there and what have you, New York being a very different state from Ohio. But Carmen DeSapio ran Tammany Hall very effectively in New York for many, many years.
Chicago, Illinois was run very effectively by
the Daley family.
Yeah, and, you know,
but
you can say, well, you know, maybe some of these organizations are so personal that there's got to be corruption. Maybe there is. I don't, you know, I'm not in a position to answer that question. But I'll tell you this, it worked. The system was very effective. They were able to marshal the team, say, look, we've decided that X is our point of view on issue A, and we're going to stick with that because that means that it will be helpful to us to get elected on a national level. And it did stick.
Carl Tuven.
We had on our side, we had Paul Butler from 1956 to 1960, who ran the Democratic Party before all the commissions, et cetera, in a very democratic way, had platform hearings, et cetera, went around the country. My friend Dick Murphy, who was Paul Butler's administrative assistant, was very, very involved in all this. And you've had other chairmen. The campaign in 1960 wanted John Bailey from Connecticut to be the figurehead chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And then Bailey lasted at the Democratic National Committee for 4 or 5 years following that. Now, John Bailey was a very different politician. He ran Connecticut like an iron, with an iron hand, and made all the remarks and all the things that, you know, had meetings, and it was Bailey's way or no way. But then all that changed in the Democratic Party going forward, and the last Democratic chairman that you had that was really a very autocratic chairman was Robert Strauss. And then you had Chuck Manatt and Paul Kirk and others who ran a very, very different party than had been going on for the last umpteen years.
We're coming up on the break, and I just want to close this out. Are we going to see major flashpoints? Are we going to see a major rallying, what do you want to call it, a boost, a get out the vote? Are these two conventions in Charlotte and Tampa going to have the effect on the American electorate that they used to have and saying, I want to vote for that party? Bob Hines.
It is likely that it will be true that both parties will get a bit of a boost out of their conventions. It's probably not as big as you would have gotten 30 years ago, but the reality is there'll be a boost. Both parties will have conventions that are successful, that the popular points of view are expressed. You know, the point with fervor at the other side saying they're not going to be able to do it, we can do it. It's going to be, they always get a little bit of a boost. It's not as big as it used to be.
Congressman Al.
Yeah, but I think when you get down to mechanical things like get out the vote and what have you, the parties still are able to do those kinds of things effectively.
Yes.
They're undramatic. They don't. Most people don't know what they're going on. But the parties run those well. It's when they start telling people what they're going to think, how they're going to vote, and all of that kind of stuff. That's a thing of the past.
Carl Tuven.
I think, you know, first of all, the Republicans have been knocked off message for 2 weeks in a row. And I think their convention is very, very important to Romney and to Ryan because they have to put their message out again and get it across to the American people, which could be a little bit difficult in this present circumstances. On the Democratic side, the president and the vice president have to really tell the American people what their vision is for the next 4 years, which I don't think they've articulated it very well up to this point. And they've got to have something new and something exciting. As far as the get out the vote is concerned, the state parties have been doing get out the vote campaigns on the Democratic side, and the Obama-Biden campaign have been for 2 years setting up their ground game. Probably one of the largest things that they've done in Democratic Party history. So all this will, you know, we'll see all this and how it shapes up following the conventions, and then of course on Election Day, we'll find out who had the best ground game.
Great observation, Carl. We're coming up on the break now. When we come back, we're going to take a little lighter side. Yesterday we lost a great entertainer in Phyllis Diller, and it reminded me of the great roast that used to have, and Phyllis Diller did a great roast of Ronald Reagan back when he was governor, and it made me go back to a time, and it made me think about a time, and we'll talk about this when we come back from the break, about a time where we didn't take ourselves so seriously as Americans. It was a much funner time. I want to think, can we get back to that time again? This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town. Yeah. Ain't coming home until the fall. And then again, I might not get home at all. Lulu's back in town. Oh, that woman's back in town. Oh, my.
And we're back here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. And we're going to take a little bit of a lighter note. We're going to talk about a recent ruling the Department of Justice has upheld
the Virginia version of voter ID and voter registration acts. We'll talk about that next week because I think that takes a lot more time than we're going to give it justice for. So we'll put that on the back burner. But what I will say is yesterday news came out that we lost a great entertainer, a great comedian. Phyllis Diller died yesterday at the age of 91, I believe. Died of natural causes. Fantastic, fantastic comedian. Also had some political influence out there on the West Coast, part of the entertainment. But I went back, and as I saw the news of Phyllis Diller's passing, I remember as a kid, a very young kid, watching my parents just howl during the Dean Martin roasts. And they would roast everybody and anybody in entertainment, politics, and I watched Phyllis Diller roast then-Governor Ronald Reagan to a point where I was just in tears. And it made me think for a second. You know, in politics today, it seems that we take ourselves way too seriously. Politics, back when I first got interested in politics as a young kid, politics was fun. It was a game. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, a Democrat could go out with a Republican, have a couple of drinks, and just let bygones, what happens on the floor stays on the floor. Now the demagoguery has just made it to a point where we're just taking ourselves too seriously. The question is, actually I posed a question to a roundtable. Congressman Al, you've been around politics for over 35, almost 40 years. Are we taking ourselves too seriously right now as Americans?
Well, I think that individuals in both parties take some issues too seriously. That is a controversial question. You say someone's going to say, you mean killing babies is not a serious issue? Well, of course that's a serious issue. And so is the deficit and all the rest. The point is you can't spend your whole time being stone-faced serious about everything. And there is a time at which you can also relax and kid each other a little bit, tease each other a little bit, and make some funny remarks about it without desensitizing the seriousness of the issue. It's that loss of ability to step away for a while and relax and tease each other that we seem to have lost.
You know, I mean, word had always been around that Ronald Reagan, in his entire political career, had a great sense of humor. Didn't take himself too seriously in many instances, as we saw on the Dean Martin roast, and as we saw in several instances, the infamous, I've just announced that we're going to, you know, launch an attack on the Russian hot monkey incident. He obviously didn't take himself that seriously. He was serious when he needed to be. Why do we feel that politics has to be always that serious, Bob?
Because we're screwing ourselves up. I mean, fundamentally, that's what the way I look at. You know, I'll tell you a story about Ronald Reagan. At the 72 convention, he was the temporary chairman.
Right.
I was on the podium as the assistant parliamentarian. And I had to go over and sit down with him. He was staying on a boat, you know, one of the canals there in Miami, and he and Nancy. And I'd never met him, and I spent about three hours with him. And he was just as easy to deal with as you could want. But he knew exactly where he wanted to go, but he didn't have a problem with the feeling that, you know, he wanted to bring other people into the play. And so we mapped out the schedule for the two morning sessions that he was going to run. And my experience with him was that he knew who he was, he knew what he wanted to achieve. He did not want any problems. He wanted it to go good, and he knew how to get it done. And he said, you know, he wanted to have people identified on the floor who he could reach and, you know, point to at you to get this talk. And he knew how to do it. Now, and he was easy with himself. He was not self-absorbed.
Right.
He was easy. He was comfortable. The only thing he didn't want to do is make a mistake. And he looked at me and he said, and you are the one who's going to make sure I don't. Literally. And we went through what he had to do and where the potentials were and how to solve the problems.
But, you know, comes to that, I mean, you know, we talk about Ronald Reagan not taking himself too seriously. We also talk about, you know, it's funny that his son was in here earlier, Tip O'Neill on the Democratic side was somebody who didn't take himself.
Oh, he could tell hilarious stories on himself. May I tell one?
Absolutely, absolutely.
May I tell one?
Yeah.
He was sitting in the cloakroom kind of entertaining the people off the floor, and he says, you know, last night I had to take a trip out to do a fundraiser, and it had been a long, hard week, and I was a little cranky. I'm going to the airport. This young man came up to me and said, hello, Tip. And I said, young man, I'm very glad to meet you, but, you know, everybody recognizes who I am. But I don't know who you are. You could at least introduce yourself. And the young man said, you're absolutely right, Mr. Speaker. I apologize. And he took 6 steps back and walked back up to him and said, Mr. Speaker, how do you do? I'm Robert Redford. Tip laughed. And then when the laughter died down, and he said, and I sat next to him at dinner the night before.
You know, there's a can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, hold on, Carl. Bob.
Let me tell you a story about Tip and Jerry Ford. Close personal friends.
Great story.
When Jerry was minority leader, Tip was the floor leader. And the two of them got along beautifully. And they cut deals all over the place, and they got things done. And as you would expect, the majority, the Democrats, were getting, you know, the biggest piece of the pie. The Republicans, they always got a piece of the pie. And so they were out playing golf one day, had a wonderful golf day. And this is, I know the story is too, because I've heard it told, each one of them told me independently, this is a story. They had a couple of drinks afterwards, and they're walking out to get into their cars. They each had a car, and they had security because they were the leaders. And the drivers were security people.
Right.
So they're walking out there, and they're arm in arm. And Tip says to Jerry, what are you going to do this evening, Jerry? What's your schedule? So he said, Betty and I have some friends in town with their kids. And they're friends of our kids. We're going to have a big cookout. And just, you know, neighborly. What are you going to do, Tip? He says, Millie's not here. So, you know, I'm going back to the office and find a way to blank you tomorrow on the floor of the house. They just fell into each other's arms because both of them knew that, you know, tomorrow the Democrats would win, but the Republicans would get something out of it.
Right, right.
And that is lost today, and it's lost because everybody is so darn serious about how important everything is.
You see John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi doing that.
No.
But I could see John Boehner and Steny Hoyer doing it.
Yes, sir.
But again, Carl Tubin, you had a comment also.
Well, the only thing I was going to say is, it's unfortunately, and we all know this, it's the way politics is played today. The two parties are so divergent. The Democratic Party, as you've mentioned, has gotten very liberal. The Republican Party has gotten very conservative. In the old days and in the days of yore, and Bob and Al can were witness to this, you know, the committees, Democrats and Republicans, would get together and have cocktails and have dinner. And they would talk about the issues, and they would try to you know, solve problems. You don't have that today. You talked about before about a bipartisan cotel. This would be great if it could be done, because then the members would get to know each other and hopefully wouldn't fight so much on the floor. Once they got to know you, it's a different story. Ted Kennedy reached out to Senator Hatch and they did a lot of good work together. Ryan and Ron Wyden introduced some Social Security legislation together. But you just don't have that going on, with everybody, with both sides of the aisle. And it's a shame, and this is the kind of thing that I know we are trying to promote, and it's the same thing. It just has to be, we have to put more time into trying to do that and trying to get the parties together, even the Tea Party people, to try to bring them in, to educate them and let them know, what they're up against and what this...
Congressman Al, go ahead.
You know, it seems to me that both parties have a remarkable opportunity at this time. They could start one could start moving toward the other. This would be harder for the Republicans right now. Parties go in cycles, and right now it's very difficult for the Republicans. So a perfect opportunity for the Democrats to start moving toward the center and take a bigger portion of the interest. Now, who stops that? Well, I would suggest it's Nancy Pelosi.
I would agree.
I think Steny Hoyer would take advantage of this opportunity. He dragged some of his liberals kicking and screaming, but his explanation to them would be, we have a chance of becoming a real majority here if we don't limit ourselves to being a little party over here on the left. While Boehner is stuck with a little party on the right.
It's a big party on the right.
Yeah.
and while he's trying to work that out, which could take years, we can move in. We're not doing that. We're not going to do that.
Right. Well, I guess that's one of the great things about this show is that we do. I mean, whether we have one listener or 1,000 or 1,000,000 listeners, the great thing about this show is it just shows that you don't have to take yourself too seriously. We've sat around having drinks, having cigars, and talking about the issues, whether we agree or not. It can still be done. It just seems that it's so, one time a year at the Correspondents' Dinner is the one time that Washington kind of lets its hair down, where back in the day, it always kept its hair down. After 5 o'clock, you could go down to any of the old bastions, whether it was the Monocle, the Hawk and Dove on the House side, and constantly see people hanging out and getting to know each other. It's a shame that you don't see that anymore. And I wish it would change. I wish it would change. We got about 9 minutes left in the show. This is my favorite part of the show, where we talk about all the gossip, innuendo, some of the scoops that we find out here in town. It's Tell Me a Story. Carl Tubin, tell me a story.
Tell you a story, and this involves the speaker. I was at a congressional dinner in the early 90s, and, Tip got up to speak, and he says, I'm not going to speak tonight, and you all will be very happy about that, and everybody laughed. He said, but I'm going to do another thing. He says, it is my wife's and I 45th wedding anniversary, and I'm going to sing to her the song that really got us together. And he belted out For Irish Eyes Are Singing. And I can tell you that there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And he got a standing ovation and was a tremendous hit.
Great story. Thank you, Carl. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
Like a lot of other people, have been watching closely what the polls are showing, not just nationally, which are really not helpful, but just many of the regional and state polls. I continue to see an uphill climb for the Republican team of Mr. Romney and Mr. Ryan. I think there are ways for them to get to the magic number of 270. But recently, I was looking at some materials that put together a number of different state polls, and the as of right now, this group's show that Mr. Romney has 190 votes on states that he is likely to win, and that Mr. Obama has like something like 213. And Florida is a very, very tough situation for the Republicans because of Social Security and health care issues.
Wow.
And so from that standpoint, it looks like it's going to be very tough for the Republicans to win. I think they can. I think there are a lot of people who would like to vote for someone, but who isn't Mr. Obama and Mr. Biden, but they're not exercised yet to do it. And I just hope that Mr. Obama, Mr. Ryan, and Mr. Romney can exercise enough enthusiasm to overcome that margin which they have to overcome.
Well, Congressman Al, you had something to say.
No, babe.
I was going to say, Congressman Al, tell me a story.
I'm going to tell you a story that is not a rumor or anything else. It's the story I told Tip O'Neill's son when we came in here, and he was sitting there at the beginning of the program. And it's a true story, and it's mine. I mean, it involved me. I was a freshman, and I was, for some reason, one night after Congress had adjourned, I was walking down one of the long hallways of the Cannon office building in the basement, dark and gray and what have you, and I was all alone. I was at one end of the hallway, and the whole hallway was open. And then I saw a puff of smoke come around the corner, way down. And then shortly after that, I saw the tip of a cigar. And then I saw a belly. And pretty soon, a gray head. And then waddling around the corner was, my God, the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill.
Pardon me for saying, you can only say he was waddling now that you're both retired.
Yeah, that's right. You would never have said that out openly, Al.
But when I used the term on his son, he nodded. You know, he was a big man.
Yeah.
He was a big man. He was heavy. He was quite a presence. But he came around the corner and started walking down the hall toward me. And I was wondering, oh, my God, what am I going to say? After I say good evening, Mr. Speaker, I better just keep chuffing on by, you know. And so we got closer and closer and closer, and I'm wondering more and more, what do I say? And finally, Tip arrives at me. And he says, hey, pal, do you know how to get to the Capitol? And it had probably been years before he'd been strolling around those lower halls all by himself without a staffer or something. And he really wasn't sure where he was. It was quite understandable, but it's a wonderful story that's
great
story. I enjoy.
That's a great story. My story this week is keep an eye on the keynote speech at the GOP convention. Keep an eye on Chris Christie's message, his demeanor, and his approach. I think, and I've been told by a couple of people inside the GOP, that Chris Christie was a very strategic pick for keynote speaker. One, it's because he's going to be a great, energized, vibrant speaker that's going to get a great message out that will appeal to all Republicans. Underlying that note, it is a setup for a possible run. Should the Republicans not win this year, it is a baseline test drive for him running in 2016. Yes, thank you, Al, for smoking my cigar again. Good Lord.
Well, I just wanted to keep it lit while you were talking.
Apparently, too. It's out now, Al. Thanks a lot. Appreciate
it
that.
It is not.
I have a great story. I'm talking about a possible future presidential candidate. You're smoking my cigar.
You weren't doing anything with it.
Oh, on that note, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Carl Tubin,
This is Justin Russell, your moderator for Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Shelley's Back Room, Bob.
The place to be.
Absolutely. We'll see you here next week, where we'll cover a bunch of topics, including the opening of the GOP convention. Have a great week, Washington.
Thank you.